Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
I want to give a big welcome to our newest business member, Jonathan and Amelia Sawyer at the Greenhouse Tavern in Cleveland, Ohio, a restaurant that uses fresh ingredients and highly developed methods of composting, sourcing alternative energy, and conservation practices. For more information, visit them at greenhousetavern.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation, an interesting conversation, thought-provoking, stimulating, and delicious conversation about food and taste. You'll note the new music, the theme music. We're going to be circling through a bunch of different tunes until we find another one that we love, but let's just get right into it. Today, I'm very excited to be welcoming back to the studio someone we had a few months ago when we began a conversation that probably could go on for years and years and years. So we're very happy to have back in the studio Fred Kaufman, who now has in his hand his latest book called Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. Thank you for coming back to Brooklyn, Fred.
Thank you, Mitchell. Thank you very much.
So you talked a lot about some of the issues last time that you've sort of woven into this fascinating story about the transformation of food from nutrients and nourishment and pleasure in some ways into something else. And I wonder if we could just start talking about what that something else is.
How food stopped being food. You know, I had a fairly simple question that I wanted to solve journalistically, which is why can't everybody on Earth have healthy, delicious, and inexpensive food?
Because that's just wrong.
but I thought to myself, how can we do this? And I thought, take out pizza. That's got to be the answer. Everybody on Earth can have pizza. And of course...
Funny to be talking about that here at Roberta's, where they make a pretty good pizza, but maybe that's not what you mean.
Well, it was sort of a tongue-in-cheek answer, because I obviously knew that really wasn't going to work, perhaps. But I used that to get me going, to understand what was going on in with global food on a very deep level. And I found myself at corporate headquarters of Domino's.
Okay.
And I started looking at what goes into this pizza. And we all know so many great writers, Pollan and Schlosser, have really shown the industrial nature of food and how food works on that level. And what I discovered at Domino's was that there's another level even beyond that where food truly is no longer food. Because what is a pizza? Well, when we look at a transnational pizza like Papa John's or Little Caesars or Domino's, mm-hmm, or Pizza Hut, right, what is it? Well, on the bottom we have commodity wheat, and that's mixed with commodity soy crush, vegetable oil. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, we have commodity cheese, which is made of commodity milk. And on top of that, we got commodity pepperoni made of commodity beef. In other words, the whole thing is a big play of these gigantic, globally traded, monstrous financial instruments. And I realized that really Domino's and McDonald's and Sara Lee, all these players are actually answering to even higher powers. And so I tried to start following, where does food get its price? Who's really calling the shots?
So let's talk about that word commodity first, just because it's thrown around a lot and I'm not sure everyone knows what it means. And in fact, I loved you included, I don't know if it was a Smith's definition of commodity, but what is when you say pepperoni is a commodity, what are we saying?
Well, there's really a two-part definition for a commodity. And the first part is that pretty much it's the same anywhere on Earth. So in other words, if you're grading a hard red spring wheat, the hard red spring wheat that comes from Nebraska is the same hard red spring wheat that can come from a field in Italy or in South Africa or in Argentina. It's pretty much the same thing. So it's interchangeable. So mm-hmm, that's number one thing. And the second part of being a commodity is this great word, which I love, called fungibility. It's got to be fungible.
Not related to fungus or meningitis or anything.
Hopefully not. Well, that's the food safety issue. No, fungibility has to do with the idea of you use something by consuming it. And the classic fungible thing that you consume as you use is money. Okay. And so if you have something like wheat, which pretty much anywhere on earth can be interchangeable with money, then it's fungible. And so that's what defines a commodity. And so we have these commodities like beef and grain and soy crush and soybeans, corn, obviously. Mm-hmm. And they are globally traded and globally arbitraged from the Ukraine to South Africa to Australia to the Midwest to Canada, all over.
And what they're trading then is not actually bushels of wheat. I remember in reading the book, I remembered images of some sitcom from the 70s where someone was trading commodities of wheat and they forgot to sell before they were delivered in a truck. And suddenly this wheat arrived and no one ever expected to have it.
Well, it's trading places, right?
Right.
Everybody understands the orange juice futures. Right. Well, this is what shocked me. And when I started looking at global commodities, because I'm a food writer, I had no idea how this financialization worked. And what I perceived, what's incredible is just as you say, people aren't actually trading 60-pound bushels of wheat. They're trading promises to either buy or to sell imaginary 60 pounds of wheat at some imaginary point in the future. And so really, the price of real food depends on people pricing imaginary food. And you might think that that's a subtle distinction, but actually there is so much more imaginary food traded out there in the world than there is real food, and it actually overwhelms it.
Was it always that way? Were the commodities exchanges ever places people went to shop for food, so to speak?
It has been completely transformed, and that is the story of this book, which is that these commodity markets were created a fairly long time ago. They were created by the ancestors of Big Ag, by Mr. Pillsbury and Mr. Archers and Mr. Mm-hmm. Daniels and Mr. Midland. And they were created post-Civil War, and they were created so that these guys could, quote-unquote, discover the true price of wheat and so that they could ultimately manage their risks, because this is a way for all the people who are in wheat, for both the big farmers and the big bakers, to have a very strong sense of what the price will be going forward, which is what every business needs. And this worked very well. It worked very well for a long mm-hmm. time. People were able to manage their risk and plan going forward. Then something really drastic started to happen around the financial crisis in 2008, and it's a money game. What happened is that all of a sudden, the largest money institutions in the world, like Goldman Sachs or Deutsche Bank or Barclays, they were sitting on a whole bunch of cash and had nowhere to put it because they could no longer put it in the stock market. They could no longer put it in real estate. They could no longer put it in mortgage-backed securities. Everything was tanking. They couldn't even put it in currencies, you know, because the currencies were tanking. Where do you put it? Well, they learned what we've known for a long time, Mitchell. Where is value in the world? Food.
Right.
That's right. And so they said, how can we get this someplace which is not going to lose value, which is going to go up? Food. And hundreds of billions of dollars upset the equilibrium of these markets.
Wow. Okay. So food is not food because food has become money.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things. And there are different variations of money. There are these strange financial instruments called derivatives. But also the book deals with how food has become a matter of intellectual property, how it's become a patent right. And the book also deals with how food has become a political football. And it deals with all sorts of ways, shapes, and forms that food has become an index and a spreadsheet and really a victim of our infatuation with the virtual. You know, we're so in love with virtual reality, but we have to remember where to draw the line. When food becomes virtual, it stops being food.
Right. And Let me take a break there and remind people, because you called yourself a food writer and I didn't properly introduce yourself, because you are not just a food writer. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with that, but we're not talking about recipes here, which some people think of sometimes. Clearly, you're a contributor to Harper's Magazine, you're a professor of journalism at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. You are talking, your book has taken you around the world, it seems like, at least from the stories that you tell, and you're on your way to Ethiopia. It's Food Day today, which is sort of an auspicious day, I think, to be having this conversation. If food, is that pizza how far have we come from that pizza just being something that everyone might be able to enjoy? Like, why does all of this impact the possibility that pizza could be the food that everyone eats and saves the world, let's say, feeds
right.
the world?
And on a certain level, pizza is a great thing in the sense that it's kind of a low meat, high, you know, high on the grain and vegetarian. It's good for you. It's also very popular globally. Yep. It's a $36 billion worldwide industry.
That's amazing.
And, you know, the great purveyors of pizza, like Domino's and Papa John's and Pizza Hut, they change their pizza. Their Russia the stores sell pizza with herring on top, and their stores in Malaysia, right? They're all different. People like different kinds of pizza, and so they are culturally sensitive to a certain extent. The king of all pizzas is pepperoni, of course. That's a popular pizza.
Not perhaps in Israel or India, for instance, but maybe beef pepperoni.
Certainly I like pepperoni pizza myself. But listen. The problem is this, which is that if we start looking at what goes into global pizza, if we start looking, let's say, at the tomato sauce that these guys are using is not the tomato sauce you make from your tomatoes that you grow on your own vines. There are very specific, highly hybridized varieties. It's really only possible to make these high-pulped tomatoes on very specific farms across the world in these high-tech ways. And what happens is, oddly enough, the more demand there is for tomatoes, the fewer tomato farmers there are. So in other words, big tomato crushes small tomato. The small farmers, the people in Ghana, for instance, the tomato farmers in Ghana, cannot make a living when all of a sudden we have European and American taxpayer-subsidized tomato paste coming into their markets and underselling them. And so what we're seeing is the phenomena of big pizza and big tomato actually driving small farmers off the land globally, off their land worldwide. And people always say, oh, trust us, big food, we can feed the world. Actually, the small farmers of the world feed more than half the world. There are 2 billion of them. They're having a really hard time. Most of them are women. They're being forced off the land to cities where they don't get a job and they can't afford to take out pizza.
Okay, so
that's a line.
Big tomato and small tomato, big pizza and little pizza. There's a lot to work with here. I'm going to remind people listening that you can call if you're listening live with questions for Fred about maybe his favorite tomato sauce recipe. I don't know. 718-497-2128. You can also write us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Or if you're listening to a podcast, or if you just prefer to communicate in 140 character tweets, you can tweet us a question at Heritage Radio, no, sorry, at Taste Matters HRN. Wow. Okay, so one of the things that I love about the book is that you take some commonly held perceptions of what might help the generally perceived problems in our broken food system, if we in fact perceive those problems and perceive it to be broken, like sustainability and like GMOs. It's another auspicious time here with Proposition 37 and labeling happening on the ballot, at least in California, in the next couple of weeks. And you complicate those understandings, the idea that the question that sustainability, whatever that means, is a goal that is going to get us away from big tomato, let's say, in that particular instance. Can we talk a little bit about what you found in your research and reporting that made you question the generally understood in the locavore food movement ideas?
I figured that if we're going to feed the world, we need to feed it in a sustainable way. And so after I was done with pizza, I thought, okay, we're not looking for the biggest food purveyors. Maybe the answer is the most sustainable food purveyors. Okay? And so then I started following this word, and and which all of a sudden shocked me, because I think we sitting here and we who are interested in locavore movement and local movement have our own very particular understanding of what sustainable means. But actually, the word has been co-opted by much larger forces once again, and most notably Walmart and Unilever, the makers of Ragu tomato sauce.
Right.
And so I tried to follow the tomato sauce in terms of this notion of how to make the most sustainable tomato sauce. And what I found in my research was that sustainability has become simply economic sustainability. It's no longer so much about the food as it is about the money. And sustainability has become one of the great marketing terms of the first decade of the 21st century. It is one of the most powerful ways for people to sell. People cannot really, let's put it this way, there are big projects funded by Walmart, funded by the California Stewardship Index for specialty crops. People trying very hard to find some sort of metric for sustainability, a right. unit of sustainability, so they actually could compare and contrast all these different products. Sadly, we might be able to get a rover on Mars, but we cannot ultimately compare a jar of ragu to a can of sardines. Which one is more or less sustainable? The details are overwhelming. Wow. And so on the one hand, it's good that we're making this thrust and that science is getting involved. On the other hand, we should be very wary of all the greenwashing out there and many claims that are coming out about sustainability.
I'm going to think about the comparison of sardines and a can of tomato sauce. While we take a quick break, we'll be right back with Fred Kaufman on Taste Matters.
You're listening to The Hill of Snowmine on Heritage Radio Network.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today. Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surifarms.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with journalist, professor, and all-around smart, passionate guy, Fred Kaufman, author of the just-released Bet the Farm, How Food Stopped Being Food. And I know we're talking about very large subjects, important, overwhelming, sometimes depressing, but you because of, I think, your magazine writing experience, it's kind of a page-turner. You know, in fact, I didn't expect to be able to read the whole thing before you got on, and I couldn't really put it down because it's such a well-told story. And I should remind listeners that if you don't get enough of Fred on this program, that you'll be reading and speaking tonight at the Barnes & Noble in Tribeca on Warren Street at 6 p.m. So sustainability, you have just said, is co-opted by some big companies as a form of greenwashing or even just really a form of cost cutting, it seems. It's been turned into money also. One thing I think we need to point out is that corporations are set up and designed.
Corporations are people, Mitchell. Corporations.
Yes. So people, let's say, are set up to make money. Like, that's what they do. So turning things into money, you know, whether or not you agree with that, we have designed the corporation to be a money-making machine. And in some ways, you know, they've been so successful at it that they've turned everything, including food, into money.
And of course, the banks are themselves simply money machines. They forget about even making the widget. It's just money to make more money in the food business. And so it's not, once again, I think that's where we have to start looking in global food justice, is really where the big money is and where that's going and how it's transforming food.
Right. So let's talk about transformation of food in a different way. The GMO, the genetically modified organism, one of the things we had a recent food conference. You were graciously served on our steering committee and were a great participant in that conference. And one of the things that I thought was fascinating in a study that we did, that Good Housekeeping did, our partner leading up to the conference of their readers, was that 38% of the people didn't even know what a GMO was. So what is a GMO and what does it... How does it enlighten us about what's going on with our food?
This is kind of the hot button issue in food right now with Proposition 37 coming up in California. And in researching this book, I literally spent about a year going from one genetic modification laboratory to another across this country. I spent a lot of time there.
Don't you wish you had his job? No, just kidding.
And, you know, it's funny because I saw some ridiculous things, like a woman who is devoting her life to creating a square tomato.
Right. Square and long, the shape of a cucumber, so it can be sliced well.
Precisely. If you get a cucumber tomato, then McDonald's will like it more. If you get a square tomato, you can pack more per box.
Right. It's like the eight-breasted chicken that everyone, the holy grail of chicken husbandry. Anyway.
Right. But I also found Dr. Pamela Ronald out at UC Davis, who actually has created, through genetic alteration, a rice which is resistant to something called Xanthomonas, which is the greatest rice blight in Asia. Okay, so these are very different things. Mm-hmm. And so whereas the discussion about genetically modified organisms has become very passionate because really we all agree on one thing, which is that corporations.
See, they got you.
They got corporations like Monsanto and Syngenta and Bayer Crop Science are really bad players, and we have to figure out a way to push them out, to stop them in their monopolistic practices and all their litigation and really their bullying. Mm-hmm. And we have to figure out how to stop them. Now, I have a somewhat different take on this after a long time, which is that I do not believe that labeling is the only or even the most efficient way to push these guys out of the business, right? So while I do believe in transparency, and I don't see anything necessarily wrong with labeling, I do see A, that who's going to pay for it, the price will be just pushed onto the consumer, and then B, it's going to create more noise on the packaging, right? That consumers already have enough noise on the packaging. So what I have been looking at is how to get the money out of it from them. And there's the Plant Patent Act of 1930, which is what is allowing the intellectual property rights and interest in these Roundup-ready crops. And I think that in Washington, this is the sort of thing that we can reform. And if we take some of the money out of it, they will no longer be so interested in their monopolistic practices. And we can start thinking about perhaps there might be something here. I don't think it's ever a good idea to really completely turn our back on science.
Mm. Do you worry, as you hear told, that by taking the money out, that the research will dry up because the potential payoff for some form of success
This is the argument you always hear. Yes. If you take the money out of it, then there will be no incentive for people to create. And of course, it's quite the opposite. When I talk to all the professors and all the scientists, the one thing stopping them from their research are all the patents. They can't do anything. They can't. Right. Every time they have to pay somebody else off.
In fact, wasn't it the patent legal issues that has kept that rice from actually being grown?
That's absolutely right. We have this really valuable rice. It's been tested. It's ready to rock. Monsanto and Pioneer, those great guys, they were gonna buy it. Then they started haggling over the terms. They lost interest. And what you have is a potentially life-saving rice never left the laboratory. There's not enough money in it.
Okay, so along with the tiny topics like sustainability and GMOs that you have complicated for us and yourself, one I was unexpected, or I found was unexpecting to find, was the question of development and the role that sort of the first world might play to help feed the third world, which is a common trope you hear in a lot of the food conversations, GMOs in particular. This is a technology that will help us feed the world, us being, of course, the people rich enough to engage in the research to do it. Talk to me a little bit about it. You seem to have an aha moment sitting in one of your heady meetings at the UN or somewhere else.
One of my heady meetings. Look, I started off with pizza, and then I kind of said, that's not going to work. And then I thought, maybe if we go really small, food can only be food if it's the molecules. But what I found is that the molecules are being controlled by the lawyers.
Ooh.
And so then I said, okay, let's go really big. Let's go to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. Let's go to the Rome Conference. Let's talk to the World Food Program. Let's see what the real, you know, the big guys are doing, you know, mm-hmm. trying to get to the answer. And what I discovered, well, not discovered, what I found is that the solution, the kind of the macro solutions to world hunger and the macro solutions to food supply, what is really in vogue right now are commodity markets. Make more commodity
right.
markets.
The market will solve everything. Yeah, markets are people too, maybe. That's right. What we need, right.
Markets are people and markets will solve our problem. And I just am wary and a little bit cynical about that. And I had an interesting question and answer session at the United Nations with, of all people, Bill Gates, who, of course, as we know, is a king of the virtual and also a prince of the market. And he believes that one of the ways to solve world hunger is to bring modern commodity markets to Uganda and Rwanda and Tanzania and Guatemala. And I am just not so sure that those commodity markets are serving the purpose they once served. I'm not so sure that they really are helping the farmers and the bakers at this point. It seems to me they're really serving the bankers.
Mm. So here's a simple question for you then.
I'll solve it.
What's the answer? Is it pizza a la Roberta's? Because, again, using that same trope, we hear the small farmer, the locavore, it's just not realistic. There are too many people. There's too much food. There would never be enough people interested in farming to create a paradigm of the small farmer feeding the hinterlands we once had. Wendell Berry was our guest with Karen Karp last week, and he certainly has a conservative view of tradition. And yet, one of the things I thought was most interesting that he said, both on that show and in our conference, was that there is a limit to farming and that that's not a bad thing. That limit is sort of what distinguishes what we've done from what we might have done, another road we might have taken. That the limit is how much a person can understand about what's going on a farm, and that industrialization of farming, which has caused all of these problems, is a maximum input activity that will never be sustainable by definition.
That's correct. That's right. Wendell Berry is absolutely right. And I always go to him, and we should all go to him for his extremely sober view of this issue. I think that there are two kinds of solutions here. The one solution is really the ultimate solution, what we're finally going to have to come to, the ultimate solution. And that's simply agroecological methods where we're in tune, better in tune with our environment, we're better in tune with how our food works, and a lot of people are already working in that area and pushing forward. And that ultimately is going to be what's going to help our planet and help our food supply and help feed all the people that will be welcoming by 2050. Mm-hmm. We can do that. Now, however, there's another level and a more immediate level. We can't necessarily have that final best agroecological solution if we don't take care of business, other business first. So we have to reform the Plant Patent Act, for one thing. We have to get the bankers out of the food supply. Dodd-Frank tried to do it. Dodd-Frank tried to push the big financiers out of commodity trading in food commodities. And just 3 weeks ago, a D.C. district court voided the law. Okay, that's the fight. So on the one level, we have a real political fight in front of us. We have a fight over food stamps. We have a fight over Dodd-Frank, right? And meanwhile, in the background, we have this unbelievable progress. And on the international front, right? I was at a meeting, one of my heady high-level meetings. I was at a meeting in which I heard Hillary Clinton, our Secretary of State, speak very recently with members of African agricultural communities. And what they were telling us is, instead of blanketing your Western-style markets on us, instead of just giving us money and telling us what to do, perhaps you guys, and I know it's a cliche, but maybe they said to us, talk less and listen more. You know, listen more to what our particular needs are in this particular situation. Maybe you can partner with us and help us that way. But don't just tell us what to do and drop tens of millions of dollars on us, because those millions of dollars, we know where they go for the most part in Africa. And they really are not necessarily being put to the best use.
Well, there you have it. Certainly, I'm still hungry for more Fred Kaufman, and I know that you will be back here, because I'll make you come back and we'll talk about some of these issues and new ones. I know you're on your way to Ethiopia for a food piece, and I'm sure that's going to be a fascinating read in Harper's. Remember, you can see him tonight, the 24th of October, on this food day at 6 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble in Tribeca on Warren Street. Next week, we are welcoming a different sort of guest, an expert in the national cuisine of Greece. She's an American living in Athens of Greek heritage, and her name is Diane Kochilis, and she will be talking about country cooking there, some of the traditional tastes and flavors and agriculture of that complicated economic place. You're listening to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis. Next week, tune in next week, I should say. And in the meantime, eat something delicious and remember that it's not just food.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Heritage Radio Network is now on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices with Stitcher. Stitcher is smart radio for your phone. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.